KKRN Community Services and Plan. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell, and I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, and metaphysics that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. The first book I'll highlight today is by Vimala Thacker, called The Eloquence of Living, Meeting Life with Freshness, Fearlessness, and Compassion, published in 1989. The second book is by Michael Reagan and Sharon Begley, called The Hand of God, which is photos from the Hubble telescope matched with quotes by famous people. The photos are just phenomenal. So anyway, let's get started. Who is Vimala Thacker? She was born in 1921 in India and became known as a philosopher, social activist, and mystic. She was a very independent Indian woman who sensed the new potential of human coexistence by turning inwards to explore the inner life. You know, for over 30 years, she traveled throughout India and the world. She met thousands of people and led hundreds of social worker camps in India. During Vimala's lifetime, 92 books were published about her work in English and translated into many other languages. Her influence spread through Asia, Europe, and America. I came across this particular book. It was on the coffee table when I first visited my husband's home. It was before we got married and we were just getting acquainted. And I thought, this is quite an interesting book that he would have on the eloquence of living in his living room. There are 8 chapters in the book, but today I'll only cover 4 of them: freedom, observation, awareness, and silence. On freedom, she wrote, "There is something in each human heart that whispers, you are free. You are not born to live in bondage, in shackles of the past. You are not born to oscillate between attachments and detachments. You are born to live in love." As I turn the pages, she continues, "Growth into the freedom of peace and silence is not the privilege of a chosen few. It's the natural state of being for everyone. We don't have to create freedom. It's there as the substance of reality. We only have to let the false drop noiselessly from us." Unless we understand the content of our whole being, freedom cannot be. Freedom is not a speculative romantic game of imagining something that it is not. It's simply comprehension of what is. Our lives can be changed and charged with freedom, the bliss of peace and the dynamism of joy, or they can become dark and heavy with our indifference, our carelessness, or our fleeting moods. The choice is ours. If we have lost respect for life, lost sensitivity of living, we cannot be free. As human beings, we're not mature. We've not learned how to live in peace with ourselves and in friendship with others, but in communion with all of life. We have learned how to exploit life, but not how to gently, tenderly love life. You know, when one feels surrounded by darkness, one can either lapse into feelings of helplessness and depression, spreading antisocial currents of frustration, bitterness, and cynicism, or one can gather the small, tender lamp of one's intelligence and understanding and walk in the light of that. If each person sees that his or her corner is illuminated, there is nothing that remains a global problem. We must create a society in which each person does not have to betray inner sensitivity, our inner essence. Each of us needs opportunities to unfold the essence of our being. Then the sensitivity becomes a foundation of strength, peace, and joy. In her pages on observation, she writes, "Growth, transformation begins with a firsthand investigation of your own mind. It begins with being aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it. You may read 100 books, but unless you look at the moment and movement of the mind from moment to moment, you'll never understand what the mind is. The state of being aware of what you're doing and why you're doing it is the foundation for inner peace. The mind is alert, sensitive, attentive, only in the absence of habits. When you go through an event absent-mindedly, passively, maybe out of habit, you're not there. The wholeness of your being has missed the opportunity for living. Habit moves, not you. This mechanical repetition creates an illusion of living, but there is neither encounter with life nor growth. You begin observing the interplay of emotions in your daily living, and you observed that perhaps today you're feeling a little jealous. You see a person richer than you, and you feel jealous not because he or she is rich, but because you feel poor. You see a person more beautiful than you, and your jealousy rises up. Your feeling has little to do with the other person. It emerges from discontent with the reality of your own life. Jealousy is not a feeling directed towards others. It's a feeling directed against yourself. The feeling arises when you're not reconciled to the fact of what you are. To be free of jealousy does not require codes of conduct or special discipline. It requires only that you see the jealousy or envy is the result of your dissatisfaction with yourself. It requires that you face what you are. Your observation becomes a searchlight on the reality of your life. Whenever you use your mind, you have to educate yourself to be totally, totally present, not absent-mindedly or half-heartedly, but pouring out your whole being into it. To be attentive is to be sensitive. You observe anger. You see all the ugliness that emotions such as anger create. The body generates heat. Blood rushes to the head. It's circulating faster. The breathing is shaky and jerky. Our whole nervous system is tense when we're angry. You may not face the fact of anger and go to the root of it. So if you want to learn how to observe, avoid struggling with the lapses and simply become aware of them. The past has no role to play. Only attention to the present moment brings our attention into the bright life of truth. Awareness. Observation and inner order make possible the unfolding of awareness. Awareness is all-inclusive attention. When you see birth as the beginning of death and death as the beginning of birth, when you see this cycle, your fears vanish. The two points lose the tension of opposites and become one cyclical rhythm, the rhythm of life. Just imagine what life would be like if there were no birth and death. Where would be the charm in living if there was only darkness or only light? We embrace the totality of it all. Here we're not exclusively attracted to beauty and pleasure. We see it all. We also see the ugliness and pain as organic parts of life. Awareness is our individual wholeness. It becomes a normal dimension of our psyche. So our thoughts are bathed in the holy waters of awareness. When we see the wholeness of being born, living, and dying, there's a joy in living and a grace in dying. When we live in awareness, we go through every experience, every relationship so completely that we never need to look back. The burden of a dark memory is never carried to the next moment. This simple, innocent unwinding and expressing of how we are is a very sacred thing. In this awareness, we live so that the very act of living leaves behind the, I like the way she says this, the perfume of dying. It is only in awareness that living creatively is possible. Awareness melts the apparent divisions between living and dying, silence and sound, light and dark. When one sees life as a whole, unfragmented, just as one sees the water of an ocean undivided through thousands, even though thousands of people have made thousands of designs on the surface of the water, the indivisibility, the unfragmented totality, is the beauty of life. Awareness of the whole of life moves a person easily and gracefully to explore dimensions of consciousness, energy beyond the superficial. When we explore life's wholeness, untouched by words, when we live in its freshness, its limitlessness, we see for ourselves the sacred, the holy, without which life has no meaning. As fish are born of water, live and move in water, and we are born of energy and we live and move in energy. Part of this energy is conditioned, and part is unconditioned. What might bring the best deep understanding of living? It happens in silence. If we want to understand life, to know of death, peace, love, we have to step away. We have to go beyond the conditioned realm of mental movements and dive into the silence. We go beyond the conditioned realm of mental movements, dive into the silence, into complete relaxation of the conditioned mental movement. We leave the shore of word and sound and plunge into the sea of silence, into space uncluttered by thought, and there we are nourished. We know nothing of silence. It's an uncharted sea. We don't know how deep it is, but we know that before we can learn to swim in the sea, we must plunge into it. In silence, there is freedom. In innocence, there is love. And in humility, there is intelligence. Silence brings us directly and intimately into communion with what life is. Being with the solitude of science, being with the limitless, nameless, measureless reality creates a new balance. It refreshes the worn-out mind and washes the psyche clean of fear. Relaxation is a tremendous event. In the relaxation of the mind, when thoughts do not move and emotions do not stir, when neurologically and chemically there is absolute equilibrium, the intelligence, the unconditioned energy, begins to operate. This non-personal unconditioned intelligence is like nature, the nature of life, the whole of it, undefined and indescribable. This intelligence, like beauty, love, sorrow, or joy, which are its expressions, cannot be captured in shapes and forms, in definitions and descriptions. All this is why life is worth living. Solitude, silence, and freedom are the great nourishers of life. We think we are nourishing ourselves with words and ideas and thoughts, but though these things are the content of our consciousness, they are not the substance of reality. In silence, there is freedom. In innocence, there is love. And in humility, there is intelligence. Silence is not an artificial stilling of the mind. It is qualitatively different. In the abeyance of mental movement, the unconditioned energy of universal intelligence is released. And this intelligence is the moving sensitivity of our whole being. With this movement of intelligence, awareness of the oneness of life blossoms, and in every encounter in daily living, there is sensitivity to the sacredness, the divinity of living. You know, faith is the flower that blossoms in the heart when we're in direct, immediate contact with the actuality of our life, when there's nothing between life and us. No thought structure, no person, no theory. It's communion between life and us. Faith cannot be faith in a person or in ideas, but only faith in relationship to the totality of living. I like the way she says that. Faith is not fatalism, which is blind acceptance. Faith receives what life brings, recognizing that whatever life presents is significant. Faith results in surrender, which is the availability of ourselves to life, to meet life as it comes, in defenseless innocence. Surrender is born of the awareness that there can be no separation from life and all its grandeur. Oh, what beautiful words to end with, that there can be no separation from life and all its grandeur. Thank you, Pamela Thacker. You know, KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through the site careasy.org. If you have any questions, call us 1-855-500-7433. Now let's enjoy the wisdom of many, many people who look at the images from the Hubble telescope and reflect on the universe. Let's begin with Albert Einstein, who wrote, "My religion consists of a humble admiration of the immitigable superior spirit who reveals himself in the slight details we are able to perceive with our frail and feeble minds." That deeply emotional conviction of the presence of a superior reasoning power, which is revealed in the incomprehensible universe. This forms my idea of God. From Ralph Waldo Emerson in his essay on nature, "When a faithful thinker, resolute to detach every object from personal relations and see it in the light of thought, shall, at the same time, kindle science with the fire of the holiest affections, and then will God go forth anew into creation." Sir Fred Hoyle, a British mathematician and astronomer, wrote this, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intelligent has monkeyed with the physics, as well as the chemistry and the biology, and that there are blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the fact that seems to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question." I like this quote from Robert Jastrow because it makes me laugh. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Physicist and 1964 Nobel Prize winner Charles Townes wrote this, "Science wants to know the mechanism of the universe, while religion wants to know the meaning. The two cannot be separated. Many scientists feel there's no place in research for discussion of anything that sounds mystical. But it is unreasonable to think that we already know enough about the natural world to be so confident about the totality of its forces." Next to an amazing colored photo of Saturn's rings on page 38 is this from Wernher von Braun. He wrote, "As science explains more of the intriguing mysteries of life in the universe, its realms expand into those arenas where previously there was either unknown or accepted items solely by faith. We are the observer of the universe, the experimenter, the searcher for truth, but we are not the spectator alone. We are a participant in the continuing process of creation. We are the highest product of that creation." In Stephen Hawking's book, Black Holes and Baby Universes, he wrote, "I still believe the universe had a beginning in real time, a big bang, but there's another kind of time, imaginary time, at right angles to real time, in which the universe has no beginning or end. This would mean that the way the universe began would be determined by the laws of physics. One wouldn't have to say that God chose to set the universe going in some arbitrary way that we couldn't understand. It says nothing about whether or not God exists, just that he's not arbitrary." In 1839, a man named Gustav Flaubert wrote this, "How vast is the creation! I see the planets rise and the stars hurry by, carried along with their light. But what then is this hand that propels them?" Good question. Next to a stunning photo of the Pleiades is the wisdom of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. "The day will come when, after harnessing space, the winds, the tide, and gravitation, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And on that day, for the second time in history of the world, we shall have discovered fire." You know, next to a Hubble photo of galaxies across billions of years is a quote by Chet Ramo, who wrote the book Skeptics and True Believers. "This new knowledge of the galaxies is exhilarating and terrifying, beautiful and dreadful. The Hubble Deep Field photo opens us to a cosmos of capricious grandeur, a universe of 50 billion galaxies blowing like snowflakes in a cosmic storm. In that wonderful image of more than 1,000 galaxies caught by a magnificent instrument lofted into space by a questioning creature, a human being. Next to a photo of the Andromeda Galaxy M31, a gigantic collection of more than 300 billion stars, that is about 65,000 light years across and 2.93 million light years away from us, is this beautiful quote from Carl Sagan. "I had an experience I can't prove. I can't even explain it, but everything that I know as a human being, everything that I am tells me that it was real. I was part of something wonderful, something that changed me forever. A vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that's greater than ourselves and that we are not, that none of us are alone." Scientist Paul Davies wrote, "I belong to a group of scientists who do not subscribe to a conventional religion, but nevertheless deny that the universe is a purposeless accident. Through my scientific work, I have come to believe more and more strongly that the physical universe is put together with an ingenuity so astonishing that I cannot accept it merely as brute fact. There must, it seems to me, to be a deeper level of explanation, and what one wishes to call it is a matter of taste and definition." Now, if you're as old as me, you remember Apollo 11, a mission that included astronaut Edgar Mitchell. He had a profound experience in space and wrote this. "Instead of an intellectual search, there was suddenly a very deep gut feeling that something was different. Seeing that sun, set in the background of a very deep black and velvety cosmos. Knowing for sure that there was a purposefulness of flow, of energy, of time, of space in the cosmos, and that it was beyond my rational ability to understand. That suddenly there was a non-rational way of understanding that had been beyond my previous experience. On the return trip home, gazing through 240,000 miles of space toward the stars and the planets, and the planet from which I came, I suddenly experienced the universe as intelligent, loving, and harmonious." Again from Albert Einstein. The important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. One cannot help but be in awe when he contemplates the mystery of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. It's enough if one tries merely to comprehend a little of this mystery every day. Oscar Wilde wrote this, "The final mystery is oneself. When one has weighed the sun in the balance and measured the steps of the moon and mapped out the seven heavens star by star, there still remains one's self. Who can calculate the orbit of his own soul?" Stuart Kaufman wrote this in A Home in the Universe. "Who seeing the snowflake, who seeing simple lipid molecules cast adrift in water, forming themselves into cell-like lipid vessels? Who seeing the potential for the crystallization of life in swarms of reacting molecules, and who seeing the stunning order for free in networks linking tens upon tens of thousands of variables, can fail to entertain a central thought? If we are ever able to attain a final theory in biology, we will surely have to see that we are the natural expressions of a deeper order. Ultimately, we will discover in our creation myth that we are expected after all." And Sharon Bagley, who wrote a lot of the narrative of this book and brought together all these beautiful quotes, says, If the mass of the neutrino were not precisely tuned, there would be no Earth-like planets, and hence no life as we know it. We are indeed the children of stardust. Stardust powered on its journey through the cosmos on the wing of neutrinos. And again from Albert Einstein. The human mind is not capable of grasping the universe. We're like a little child entering a huge library. The walls are covered to the ceilings with books in many different tongues. The child knows that someone must have written these books, but it does not know who or how. It does not understand the languages in which they're written. But the child notes a definite plan in the arrangement of the books, a mysterious order which it does not comprehend but only dimly suspects. There are two photos from the National Solar Observatory of dying stars in this book, and one shows hot plasma bending into a loop due to strong magnetic fields. And then there's another shape that looks just like a turtle. And the quote next to it is by H.L. Mencken. Penetrating so many secrets, we cease to believe in the unknowable. But there it sits, nevertheless, calmly licking its chops. Jane Goodall said, "No wonder we're confused by the tiny fraction of a hole that we see. After all, it's like trying to comprehend the panorama of the desert or a sea through a rolled-up newspaper." Next to a photo of the Whirlpool Galaxy with its spiral structure is a quote by Julian Jaynes. "Why should we demand that the universe make itself clear to us? Why should we care? It's something about understanding the totality of existence, the essential defining reality of things, the entire universe and our place in it. It's a groping among stars for final answers, and a wondering, the infinitesimal for the infinitely general, a deeper and deeper pilgrimage into the unknown." A picture from the Apollo 17 trip around the moon resulted in a composite picture with part of the moon in front and the Earth off in the distance. Astronaut James Irwin wrote this. "The Earth reminded us of a Christmas tree ornament hanging in the blackness of space. And as we got farther and farther away, it diminished in size. Finally, it shrank to the size of a marble, the most beautiful marble you can imagine. That beautiful, warm, living object looked so fragile, so delicate, that if you touched it with a finger, it would crumble and fall apart. Seeing this changed me. And it has to make all of us appreciate this creation." Johann Wolfgang von Goethe put it this way: "The highest happiness of man is to have probed what is knowable and quietly to revere what is unknowable." Next to a photo of the butterfly nebula, M29, it actually looks like a supersonic jet plane exhaust. And there is this quote by Blaise Pascal. "For after all, what is man and nature? A nothing in relation to infinity, all in relation to nothing. A central point between nothing and all, and infinitely far from understanding either. The ends of things and their beginnings are impregnably concealed from us in an impenetrable secret. We are equally incapable of seeing the nothingness out of which we are drawn and the infinite in which we are engulfed." Sharon Begley wrote, "Maybe the indifferent heavens will offer a sign, however small, that there is a world beyond the world we see, that there is meaning in the void and a harmony between the mind and the limitless reaches of space. Closing that gap, that limitless reach, has been the 20th century's high-powered telescopes, bringing us images so far beyond what we could ever imagine that they've changed dramatically our view of the heavens and the origins of the universe." I'll wrap this up with a writing by John Gillespie McGee Jr. called High Flight. "Oh, I have slipped the surely bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter's silver wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds, and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. I've wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the delirious, burning blue sky, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace. Where never lark or even eagle flew, and while with silence lifting my mind, I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space and put out my hand and touched the face of God. I hope you've enjoyed hearing the wisdom from so many about the eloquence of living and our life here in the mysterious universe. The music for this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses, and it even comes with a full-color booklet on their adventures. So until next week, may peace be with you.